This is the Skirted Roundtable. I'm Linda Merrill from Surroundings.
And this is Megan Arquette from Beach Bungalow 8.
And Joni Webb with Cove to Texas.
And this week on the Skirted Roundtable, we are thrilled and truly honored to welcome Charlotte Moss, someone that so many of us look up to and revere for such an amazing career. So Charlotte, thank you so much for joining us at the Skirted Roundtable.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be here. This is my first chance at doing something like this.
Well, we're excited to have you on the forefront.
I must chime in and say one thing to start with. My mother is going to keel over and die when she listens to this, Charlotte, because she loves you. I love you. And you are like a bond we have between each other. You know, every time you have a new book out, I buy it for her and we go over it page by page on the phone and discuss everything. She's going to die. She's going to be so excited. We are so honored to have you.
Oh my gosh. So I've gotten to that age now where we're into the mothers, right?
Yes. Yeah. But she's got great taste, so it's a compliment.
Okay, great.
Okay. Charlotte, what we'd love to hear, and I know our listeners would love to hear, is you worked on Wall Street, and then you transitioned into interior design. And how did you make that transition from one career into another that became such a success?
Well, you know, it's really funny about how the transition occurred, because in one way, I sort of transitioned into Wall Street because of a move, and moving back to New York and deciding that that was the place that I was going to be able to go and hopefully make some money. But after I'd done that for a while, and I knew I wasn't going to do it the rest of my life, I had to do something else, and I knew what it was going to be. It was going to be decorating, because that's really where my heart was. It was in my genes. It certainly consumed all of my extra time. I was exposing myself to as much as I could, whether it was a museum or just reading everything and get my hands on. The firm that I was working for was bought by a larger firm. And so that really forced me to think about what I wanted to do. Is it time now? Because I think I was 34 at the time. Is it time to jump off the cliff and do something new? Or did I really want to go to another Wall Street firm because they were all recruiting because of this merger? Mm. And I think this was it. So I took my last bonus. I went to England, bought a container, and said, I'm just going to have to give it a go. And that's what I did.
What's your background before you were on Wall Street? Did you go to school? Did you have an educational background in the arts or any part of that?
I majored in English. I didn't really officially minor in art history, but I took every credit I could in art history. And I studied, a little design with a private studio in California for a very brief period of time when I lived there. And I just think it's sort of in your genes. I mean, don't you just kind of feel it sometimes?
Yeah.
You know, when you get excited about something, you know, it wasn't about tax shelters or, you know, what the Dow did today that really turned me on. It was more about seeing a beautiful house in a design magazine.
I've read that you used to decorate your desk at Wall Street. And you got in trouble for that. I know that feeling. I was a secretary. And I always had the prettiest desk, you know.
It had to be tidy, for one, you know, because we all know that the bottom line threshold of this entire business is all about good housekeeping. But seriously, what can you do, you know, when everybody's got the same standard issue desk? You know, I went out and bought some great baskets for my end baskets and always had flowers.
Did you have the colored folders, file folders?
No, we had, you know, the company issued ones.
I did that in my job before I made the transition, as all my file folders started to be wild colors because it was all I could do.
That would put them over the edge. Because when I wore a bright colored suit, every once in a while someone would say, well, you know, we have so-and-so from XYZ Corp coming in tomorrow for lunch in the corporate dining rooms, and could you not wear that red suit?
Oh, that's
sure. I'll never get that. And it was like, sure, no problem. But I won't wear a bow tie. Don't make
Yeah.
Was this in the 80s? The sort of women's issue blue suit bow tie kind of?
Yeah.
The Falard tie.
Dress for Success, remember?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, I think it, what's most fascinating is that you are completely self-taught, and you said that it's because you couldn't draw, and I think a lot of us can relate to that. We, you know, a lot of us can't draw, and today the design schools are so built around the drafting part of it, you know, but it's true. It's either in your blood or it's not, and they can't teach you, they can't teach it.
Well, you know, I do think that, you know, if someone said to me, do you have any regrets? I think probably that would just be one of them, is not being forced to take a drawing class somewhere along the line. I think it's so important that you are able to communicate what's going on in your gray matter and how it gets translated through a pencil.
No, I was just going to ask you, who was with your very first client? I'm curious who that was, and then how did you convey your design, what your ideas were, if you weren't drafting?
Theme boards, photos, storyboards. You know, I'm a great clip artist. You know, I have like plastic tubs full of clip art, and it really comes in handy. It's just a great way. I think also being able to articulate visually on behalf of a client. In other words, take what they tell you and for you to interpret that and put it in the form of a storyboard and give it back to them and say, this is what I thought you said about where we were going. And then mm-hmm. there's either yes or no. So I've just found the storyboard approach works for me. I do it for clients. I'm a big scrapbooker. I catalog a lot of different things, whether it's my garden or, I'm sitting here looking at these big 11x17 books that we do, and there's one on lighting, there's one on floor patterns, stonework, and I just keep building and building and building ideas so that whenever I'm having a meeting with a client, I can either pull theirs or I can pull any number of books that I have to help me visually express what I'm trying to say to them. And I think a lot of people don't know how to use the words to tell you what they want, but they can give you a clipping.
Yeah.
Charlotte, so you're saying when you're in a meeting with a client, you will pull your own scrapbook of clippings and go through it with the client and say, do you see anything you like? Is that what you're saying?
No. I do storyboards specifically for the client.
Right.
But we have resource books that I have put together over the years on various topics. And let's say we're getting into a discussion about the pattern of the stonework in the foyer. And we just sort of start talking about that. I'll pull out my reference book on stonework and say, well, let's just take a minute to look through this and see if any of this is in the right direction before we mm-hmm. go off and start drafting and drawing.
And but you don't do that with the client. You do that with your assistants.
No,
with the client.
Okay.
With the client, too.
Okay. That's what I was wondering.
And these are books that are clip books that you've put together on topic-specific areas. And then while you're working with a client, you're also putting together a client book of all of their ideas. That's great. I think a lot of people...
Specifically for them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do they keep that... at the end of the project, or do you keep that for them for a historical reference?
We usually scan them and make them a duplicate copy because most of our clients are out of town.
Yeah.
And it gives us a vehicle to sit and review on the phone together.
Yeah.
It's really what sort of keeps you from one meeting to the next sometimes is being able to go back to those visuals.
Where is your first meeting with a client held? At your office or their house? I mean, the first meeting, is it? We had this big discussion about this with Vincent Wolf, and he always has the client come to his office first. And I was just curious, do you have that rule?
I hate to use the word rules because I just hate rules, but I think it depends on how many conversations you've had with the client prior to the first meeting. If you've had enough conversations with the client prior to that, then yes, definitely in your office. I generally don't like going to a job site or a house you know, I hate to say that there's a rule, mm-hmm. but, you know, there are just times when you get there and before you know it, it's what are we going to do here and what are we going to do there? And you haven't even been hired yet.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's, you know, it's always so, you know, so in a way heartwarming to know that the designers at all levels yeah. Of their career experience that same issue with clients.
Oh, yeah, it's called the, you know, perpetual beauty contest.
Yeah.
they're out there, you know, picking your brains.
Kicking the tires.
Yeah. And then they wait for the next person to come in so they can pick their brains.
Yeah.
And then their sister-in-law does the project.
Right.
Sorry, been there, done that. I'm too old for that nonsense.
Yeah.
So what is the process? Because I think a lot of designers who are listening to this are going to relate to this, because all of us can relate to this, where you go in and before you know it, just like you say, you drive by the house one evening and you can see through the windows and you go, they did exactly what I, you know, somewhat what I told them to, but some, yeah, their sister-in-law did it for them. So what process do you do to avoid that? You go to the home or they come to you?
They come to us. I think okay. that also establishes, I think when a client comes to you, it says something about their level of seriousness mm-hmm. and commitment, that they've had to
make an effort.
Make the
That's
effort.
That's true. Yeah. That's really true, y'all. Yeah.
And if they're not making, look, it's a two-way street. I cannot ever deliver for a client if they don't give me enough information so that I can go about my business to come back to them with what I think they want. I mean, it's a constant conversation, and it's about being honest and open. But it means a commitment, because we don't wave magic wands. We can only create. We're only as good as the client. I mean, really, in truth, that is it. I mean, you know, Mario Bawada said that a long time ago when I first got into this business. I'll never forget it. You're only as good as your client, but it is our responsibility to delve into the most personal thing in a person's life, because you're creating their home. It's got to work. It's got to function. It's got to be practical. It's got to be beautiful. That's a lot of requirements.
I really appreciated in the interview in Elle Decor with Mitchell Owens regarding the Vision Award, you were asked, what is the most essential element of a room? And your response was atmosphere. I just thought that's mm-hmm. such a great way of looking at it.
Well, because to me, that's the ultimate goal, because how many times have we all walked into a house and it just, ooh, felt great, looked great. And when you broke it down, you really couldn't break it down, but there was just something about the house that made you feel good. And that's the quality that ultimately you look for, because mm-hmm. anybody that's not colorblind can pick a paint color and go pick a fabric for curtains. I mean, that's not what decorating is at all. I want my clients to feel like the minute I walk out that they could have a party and feel at home, not feel scared of it, not feel that insecure about it, but to feel like they've been there for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
just pick up the phone and invite someone over.
Well, I'll tell you, I had a little personal touch with your work, which was this summer I went to Edith Wharton's in the Berkshires, and the living room was just so beautiful. And all I wanted to do was sink into the sofa and just enjoy it. It was just such a beautiful room.
Mm, well, thank you. You know, that was an interesting project, because we were asked at the time to do what Edith would do today.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
yeah. When we created those spaces. And so I did all the research on what that room was, and there were only like two pictures out there that represent just portions of what that room was like. And I decided that I was not going to try to second guess what Edith Wharton would be today. I just wasn't that smart. So I tried to reconstruct it in a 20th century, you know, more modern kind of way, but still honoring Edith. And anyway, I hope there were a lot of people going through that room at the same time, because, you know, it's all about raising money to keep it going.
Right, mm-hmm. right. Yeah, no, it was a really, I wish I'd seen the whole show house. The only two rooms left decorated were yours and Bunny Williams. And but the living room was very a complicated room because it was long and narrow and dark. And
everything that was in that room that we managed to get donated, or I donated it myself so that that room could stay intact.
Yeah, yeah, it's just beautiful.
Charlotte, you were talking about when you finish with a job, you like the client to feel they can have a party. Now, you do this for all clients. I read where you set the table with their china and you take pictures of it so they'll know. I mean, you really finish the job, and you take vases to the florist and have them take pictures so they'll know what flowers, after you're through, your work continues in the little details. Do you do that with all clients?
Well, the ones that really want it, and it's not to suggest that people don't know how to set the table, but I think that what happens is we all end up accumulating a lot of things in our lifetime, and sometimes it takes a fresh eye to come to that collection and create new combinations. Mm-hmm. So what I do is I take all their china, silver, crystal, linens, whatever, come up with every conceivable combination, photograph it, and create a book for them. And it's interesting because it's kind of like shopping your closet. You've gotten more stuff than you thought. And then when you start having fun and also showing people that doesn't have to match, you can mismatch, you can dress up, dress down. Look, we sit down at the table every day. Why shouldn't it be as beautiful as the rest of the decorating? And I have a lot of fun doing that. But also with some clients that aren't big gardeners and don't know the names of all their flowers, it's just a helpful way to make them feel more secure about being able to call their florist and say, those amethyst bowls I have? What do you have in the way of whatever to go in them? And then when they can even suggest certain flowers to go in there because we've given them a list. Or they can call up and say, I just need that single blossom of Casablanca or stems just to go in my bud vases around the table. And we just give them a list of flowers. We photograph the vases. They have a list. We have a list. And they give the florist the list or the book, depends on how much it is. But I think it's all about, in addition to the atmosphere, I think the single most important thing that you could do for someone in designing their house is to make them feel comfortable in it. It's sort of amazing sometimes the number of people that have gorgeous, gorgeous homes and don't entertain a lot because they're insecure about it for one reason or another. And I think that's a crime. So I think it's really important that one of our jobs is teaching. And to the extent that we can do anything that makes people feel confident and comfortable with what they have, that would be one of the greatest byproducts of the process.
I like how you had mentioned in that same, that interview that Linda had mentioned, that, a lot of people know a lot of about decorating, but bringing it all together is the designer's really their job. And I think that that's so important that to mention, because I feel like there are a lot of people out there who misunderstand the role of the designer, the bringing it together, the talent that lies behind that.
Well, that's your value added. I mean, if your job is not just to shop,
right,
and to look for beautiful things and fabrics, but it's that end result, it's that atmosphere that's created because it's obvious that all the details were tended to. And I think that there are a lot more people out there that can shop for beautiful fabrics and color and put it on a sofa and kind of get it right. And then when it comes to the lampshades, they're like, look like granny lampshades. They're all shaped wrong. They're cheap. The accessories don't hold up to the rest of the decorating. Just the little details aren't there.
I must say, your lampshades are spectacular. They're gorgeous. Do you always use the silk? You always custom yours. I know that, I'm sure. They're just beautiful. They're gorgeous. And you're right. It's the little details. But that's a lot of work you're describing. It's a lot of intensive work with a client. Do you have a lot of clients in a year or?
No.
Okay.
Right now we're working on about 3 projects.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just fine for me.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we do other things. You know, the firm is not interior design solely.
Right.
Between licensing, writing books, lecturing, and doing other things, it's a diverse design business.
What is your favorite of the products that you license, whether it's the china or fabric, what is your favorite element of the design of those products? Do you have one?
Oh, yes. I would say it would be the next license.
Yeah. Well, you're coming out with a new fabric line for Fabric Cut.
Oh yeah, you know, I was just kidding.
I know, but I'm so excited about that because I love Fabric Cut. It's not usually expensive, and so it's a way for everyone to get, you know, your eye or your look and be able to afford it. I'm thrilled. I can't wait. When do you think that will be coming out?
That's early 2011.
Okay.
About the same time as next book. It takes about 18 months to do a collection.
What is your next book?
The next book is also Spring of 11. And that will be... Did you ever see the little book we did called Design Inspirations?
Yes. About the Kits Bay house?
Yes. It was based on 4 rooms and how they came up. We're doing 10 rooms like that in the next volume, a bigger book, and it'll have a lot more in way of resources, and also the build-up to creating a room, and alternative places to shop as a result. It's a way of taking all of those designer show house rooms and making them even more accessible.
Mm-hmm.
Great idea.
So the resources will be very, very broad. But, you know, when it comes to Fabric Cut, one of the reasons that, you know, they really, really appeal to me as a licensee and why I'm really excited about this collection is because they do have that depth in their organization. They have great reach in the marketplace, and they can create a beautiful product at a price that makes my design more accessible to more people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, if I'm doing a couple decorating projects a year for people that can afford to hire us to do the whole thing, this is an opportunity to take what you've learned doing those projects to a much bigger market. And
you will still be at Brunswick, though?
The collection that we've created for Brunswick will still continue to be sold there.
Okay. That's a gorgeous collection. I love that collection. Oh, the pinks are so pretty. I'm just stunned by what Charlotte is saying about what she does for a client. I think we're all probably overwhelmed. Don't y'all agree?
Oh, I think I love all that stuff. I do too.
I mean, I feel so guilty that I don't take it to that level, you know?
This is why I love speaking to designers.
Yeah.
You know, there aren't very many of Charlotte Moss's level because you learn these things. I mean, I'm sitting here like a sponge just absorbing all of it because I mean this in a very strong way. There's such a feminine way that you go about your business and your design that, I mean, I think that's why it's very appealing visually, but now I'm hearing from the business side of it, there's really a feminine energy that goes into your business. And I think it's another reason why I'm sure your clients love to work with you and why the end result is always just perfection.
Well, you know, thank you very much. I appreciate that. You know, I think another part of that could be being Southern too. Because, you know, Southerners love their homes and, you know, more than anything, you know, I just remember growing up, getting together at my grandmother's, getting together at my aunt's, my mother inviting everybody over for dinner. You know, it was always, everyone was welcome. So I grew up in an environment where people shared their homes. And so that's my ultimate goal, is to make sure that my clients feel the same way. And you do it in such a involuntary way. I mean, you don't, it's not because someone asked you to do that. It's kind of like, well, this is what we do. And if you don't need it, that's fine. But, you know, we'll help you build your library too. Look, I love setting the table so I can live vicariously doing other people's. Mm-hmm. And whether it's their flowers, you know, I'm a gardener, so that just gives me another outlet. And I think designers that don't do that, in some ways, I mean, there's an opportunity there for designers to be even more important in the lives of their clients, mm-hmm. because they do everything. It's like any big corporation that's vertical, you know, everything from within. You have an opportunity to do everything. I've designed people's book plates for their libraries. I've helped some of my clients get dressed. You know, whatever it is, sent them to certain designers to go visit. There's so many things that your client relies on you for because you are who they've known to depend on for their home, and it's about style. So why shouldn't it translate to other things?
You become the harbinger of all things beautiful in their lives. And I remember reading you actually will design, I don't know if they're letterpress, but stationery. Yeah, the stationery.
Oh, yeah.
People's homes. I love that. I love
that. Design stationery, the monogram, pick the color. You know, this morning I went to Arkevia Books here in New York to, you know, a client asked me to just pick out all the new exciting design books and anything else I saw and have them shipped to her, you know, because then, you know, she sort of got the list that I have and she knows that I like them. And then she's at least got that and she can go off and explore on her own to see how she wants to add.
I will say that you inspired me. I was reading an article that you were going on and on about your Kindle.
Oh, was I going on and on again? Oh, dear.
About your Kindle. And yeah. I really didn't know what it was, and I bought one last month. I love it now. But I bought it because on your recommendation, the Kindle.
What do you read on it? You can read books on it?
Yes, it's fabulous.
Oh my gosh, it'll give you religion. Let me tell you, I'm a voracious reader, so anything that sort of facilitates that is a great tool. And what happened, a friend of mine. That she was using hers a lot. And I went, oh my God, reading a book on a screen? I don't think so. She goes, Char, she whipped it out of her pocketbook. She goes, look at this. I was riveted. So I bought my Kindle. And, you know, it's interesting. When I go on a trip, I mean, I'm sure you're the same way. You go on a vacation, what do you have? I have a tote bag of magazines and books and my journals. That's one whole suitcase.
Right. Just right.
And, you know, I'm just a paper-intensive person, but my Kindle saves me from having to carry several books because, there are a lot of books out there that we all love to read that aren't going to be downloadable onto a Kindle because they're visual.
Mm-hmm.
But it just makes reading so portable because if you're on vacation or wherever you are, on an airplane, doesn't matter, in the back of a cab and you're stuck in traffic, I can read the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, I can read magazines, I can read blogs, and I can read a book. So whatever mood I'm in, I pick up that Kindle, and I can read whatever book I feel like I'm in the mood that I've downloaded, that I'm in the mood for. And if someone just recommended a book to me, like if you just right now gave me the name of a book, I
could have it, yeah.
And download it and start reading.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
You can do magazines on it, too?
Yeah.
You can do magazines on it, too.
Do you have the big one or the small one?
I have the original.
Yeah.
I have the original.
You should get the big one. I bought the big one. I love it.
How big are they?
It's like 8x10, maybe?
Yeah, the big one is.
The big one, yeah.
Smaller, like 7x9 or smaller.
Oh, I had no idea they were that big, because in my mind, they were always about the size of a cell phone.
No, they're bigger.
Oh, okay. Well, I've never seen one. I know what they are. I've never seen one in person.
They're incredible. But thank you, because now I'm a Kindle lover because of you.
Oh, no, it's a great thing, and I think they're only going to improve. I would just like to not have so many gadgets now between the BlackBerry and the Kindle and then the laptop and then, you know, the digital camera and my little miniature Polaroid printer and all these things that I use, it's like, just wish it could all be one screen.
I know.
Mm-hmm. But we'll be there. We're getting there. Yeah. Look what we're doing right now.
I know.
You know, I mean, this morning I was taking pictures of some finials with my BlackBerry to immediately email to a client because I'm designing a Corona for her bed, and they were antique Italian finials. And I just took a picture, emailed it to her, and she emailed right back. Perfect.
Oh. So it's done.
Well, that worked.
Well, it sounds dreamy to me. I'd love to see it. That you were using antique finials on a Corona for bed.
Mm-hmm.
You make the prettiest beds. I think that's something you're really known for is your bedrooms. Your beds are usually four-poster. How you talk a man into it, I don't know, but you do. And
don't talk to him. You don't talk to him. You do it.
Yeah.
You know what? Most of my clients are female, and the decorating has been delegated to them.
Right.
So the fact that, and I will say this, someone would tell their wife that they couldn't have a bed of a certain type. I don't know. I mean, my husband always says, whatever works for you, Char. I mean, I'm very lucky. But, yeah. I mean, what's the big deal? We're talking about four posts with some curtains on them when you break it
off. How about when they say, my husband would never let me have pink or a flower on a print. You know, why? Is it going to turn
you know what? Whose bedroom has the four-poster bed with pink and all the flowers? Someplace else, maybe? You know?
That's interesting, yeah.
Well, I mean, I doesn't a guy like that have some issues? I mean, I don't know. I'm always a little reluctant to make statements like that, but I find that somebody has to go through their entire life in the most private room in their entire house, not having it the color they want or the kind of bed they want because their husband thinks it's going to, like, you know, emasculate
them.
Yeah, it's all about emasculating.
Do you find, have you found when you're dealing with that issue, Charlotte, do you find any regional differences? Because we actually have had this conversation with the three of us, and Joni was definitely on the, you know, why would a husband care? I don't care what the husband says. You know, that's just the way it is. And Megan and I kind of wondered if there was a southern aspect to that versus northern. Because I get it all the time where the husband wants the say, not the say, but.
I think it's an individual thing.
Yeah.
That just some men that are just really insecure about that. And I had a client once who was trying to second guess her husband. And he called me up one day and we were talking about things. And he said, are you kidding? I would love a feminine bedroom with all that stuff.
Huh.
And she didn't even know because she hadn't asked him. But, you know, it's okay to tell them too, you know.
I just wrote a blog about declaring that I'm a feminine designer and I don't like masculine designers. And a man can be a feminine designer, you know, like Mario Buada is definitely a feminine designer. And I said my favorite male client is when I meet him for the first time is after the installation.
I have a very butch side in my decorating when it comes to doing libraries and men's rooms because I love very austere furniture too, like Directoire and Empire. And I love those bold statements and big architectural pieces. I mean, that's just another interest of mine. So whenever I get a chance to sort of express that, I'm all over it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not all four-poster beds.
I know that, and which is interesting. I want to ask you this. You know, like, Belgian is so hot right now. Do you ever go home and say, I'm done with this French. I want an axle, you know, look. And do you ever have that feeling, you know, where you're of two minds, you know?
Oh, I'm always of two minds. But, you know, one always ends up ruling in the end. And I think when you're in the business, you're always seeing what's new and you have to stay up on it because your clients want to know your opinion and your take on certain things. And look, we're all want to experiment. There are times when I have experimented and then I've just had to like collapse and say, you know, that just didn't work for me. I'm just not spending time in that room because I thought I wanted something. And, you know, anyway, I got over that. But I think you have to experiment and I think you have to take risks. And, you know, of course, you have to be careful with what you take risks with because of the expense. But I love that whole Belgian look, you know, bleached oak furniture and the whole that whole aesthetic.
But not in your house.
It's not totally my house.
Yeah. I'm dying to see your new Aspen house is coming out next month. Is that right? Is it in the El Decor?
Yes.
I'm dying to see it because I love the winter house that, oh, I loved your old one so much. Is it different? Totally different or?
It's different.
Yeah.
It is different.
I'm just looking forward to seeing what you will do with an Aspen home. I've seen a lot and been in a lot of those homes and I know you're going to do it completely differently than what everyone's done, you know, in the past. So I'm really looking forward to that, to seeing what you've done.
Well, I'll tell you what you won't see. There are no buffalo paintings.
I love it. What else? I want to hear what else because I have in my head a checklist.
Oh, no, you'll see.
No,
okay.
We'll wait.
You know, I've seen the photographs, but obviously haven't seen the layout. So I am really looking forward to seeing what Peggy and her team at the magazine have done to that story. So looking forward.
Who was the photographer?
Peter Esterson.
Oh, yeah.
And Peter,
you use him all the time.
I love Peter. He's an extraordinary person. I love working with him.
Charlotte, I just wanted to mention before we wrap up, I wanted to mention to you that my husband and I do a lot of philanthropy, and I really appreciate it when somebody, you know, who has a lot of success and who is very public also contributes to the world, gives back. And so I wondered if, you know, we could talk a little bit about the philanthropies that you are involved with. And I know that, you know, you're seen a lot at different, at the ballet, at the New York City Ballet and Operation Smile, and you do some things for those philanthropies. What are you currently involved in?
Well, you know, first let me just say that I think that we all have an obligation at a certain level or any level that's possible and that anyone's capable of giving something back. And philanthropy is, you know, not for just wealthy people. Philanthropy has to do with, sure, giving money, but it also has to do with giving time.
Right.
And, you know, we all have times in our lives when we, you know, we have the time to, where we can volunteer. And then we reach a point in our careers where we have less time for volunteering, but we sit on a board, we add the value that we can, and financially we contribute what we're able. So that's sort of like my speech on philanthropy, but I think that there are times when the giving is related to what you do. I'm on the board of the executive committee at Bard Graduate Center, which is all about the decorative arts, and that's a way for me to add value that I can because this is my business, but also an opportunity for me to learn from great people that are also in that group. So it's so much of what I call a grown-up give and take that we give and then we get at the same time. And it's not just about giving money. I mean, we have charities here in New York like Housing Works, which I'm not on the board of, but I participated in some of their events. So I've been able to take what I do as a professional, as a designer, and create a vignette for them where everything in the booth is sold and, you know, it's an event that has great energy, and that's another way of giving back, and plus just donating things to them that, because I'm an accumulator and I have too much stuff in my warehouse, I can afford to donate. I've just gone on the board of the Bone Marrow Foundation, which raises money to help people make possible being a part of a bone marrow transplant where they might not have been able to be there because of finances. And that's important to me because I went through a bone marrow harvest and transplant for my brother who had leukemia. And so these are things that are part of your life that way you have an opportunity to give back. And you know, I've met some amazing people. You know, being close to dancers and musicians at the New York City Ballet has enriched my life. But yet I've done what I can for them by chairing events and help raise a lot of money. So I could go on and on and on about philanthropy because there are just so many ways we can all do something. I don't care if it's $5 or $50,000. Everybody can do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you because I think that that's such an important message. And, you know, you being an idol to so many people, really, I think that people need to hear that message. And as you said, just that even time matters. And I love your message about, you know, having the experience, it's almost, you know, you need to give it away in order, you know, not in order for anything, actually, just giving it away is just such a wonderful way to live life. And I think that's really refreshing to hear.
Well, you know, and I think also that, you know, I've had people, you know, ask me questions in Q&As when I've given lectures that say they don't have time to do that. And, you know, maybe there are people that don't have time, but they can write a small check. They can put loose coins in the UNICEF trick-or-treat boxes wherever they are. There's something we can all do. So anybody that uses I'm too busy, I just sort of give them a blank stare. And I don't know what else to do, but I can't have a conversation with that person. Otherwise, they're going to have to pull me over in the corner with them and I'll make them a convert. I don't understand because when you want to do something, we all know that.
You can do it, yeah. I think I have one last question. Do you sleep? Do you require a lot of sleep?
No, I don't require a lot of sleep, but like lately I've required more. 5 hours is good for me.
Yeah, that's what I thought. That's what I figured. It seems like a lot of very successful type A, I don't mean that negatively, but you know, very successful, driven people that accomplish a lot do not require a lot of sleep. You know, I think of Martha Stewart, Bill Clinton, they all, you know, are famous for not requiring a lot of sleep.
You know, I used to make apologies for being wired, and I just think, you know, you're just sort of wired a certain way, and I love what I do, whether it's the charities that I'm involved in professionally, writing a book, teaching students. I love what I do. And I just think your mind is always going. I mean, there's sometimes I could give it a rest more, but you know, you're just always thinking. And when you surround yourself with similar people that are excited about it, it really just becomes contagious. It's hard to turn it off sometimes. But when I go on vacation, I can turn it off.
Well, that's good. It's good to know that, you know, you do need to get it. When you get away, you're actually away. With your Kindle and your...
I have my Kindle and my journal and my digital camera and my husband.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, Charlotte, thank you.
He's darling, by the way. I think he's so cute, her husband.
Oh, he's still married to me. Can you believe it?
How long have you been married?
He's darling, though. He's darling looking, I think.
What's that?
How long have you been married?
Oh, it's 24 years this week.
Oh, okay.
Wow. Happy anniversary.
He's a saint. He's a saint.
Well, Charlotte, thank you so much for joining us. We were, as I said, honored, and we're not just, you know, saying that. We really are. And,
yes.
You know, you just, yeah, you've just shared, you know, a lot of really great stuff that a lot of times doesn't come out in print or interviews, you know, your process and stuff. And so I think that our listeners are just going to be thrilled to hear what you've shared about how you work your business and work with people.
You know, I think this is an incredible vehicle, and I'm so glad that you three are doing this, because I think there's no substitute for the voice and the enthusiasm and a voice and all the things that just sometimes can't get translated in the printed word.
We have figured that out. It's amazing. Like, we have sat here and we have been enraptured by what you are saying. And
yeah.
I mean, you can't imagine. To you, it's in your head, but it's not in our head. So just listening to it, it's so enlightening. You know, it really is.
Yeah, definitely.
I do think that we forget what we all bring to the table, and then collectively what we additionally can bring. And so I think opportunities like this are really fun.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. This has been the Skirted Roundtable with Megan Arquette from Beach Bungalow 8, Joni Webb from Coat to Texas. I'm Linda Merrill from Surroundings, and this week we welcomed Charlotte Moss to the table. You can join us online at www.skirtedroundtable.blogspot.com or download our podcasts from iTunes. Search for The Skirted Roundtable. Thank you so much, and we'll be back soon.